This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
From 6 to 7 p.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at kboo.fm.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
Yeah. And good morning. Welcome to another edition of the Old Mole Variety Hour, brought to you by the continually corporate-free KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Ivan Hale, and our engineer is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour is one of the many locally and voluntarily produced programs brought to you by this radio station. We are not syndicated nationwide, but we bring you news and commentary, movie and book reviews from a national, nay, international perspective. We are a collective, choosing to find power in our diversity and at times differing opinions. By utilizing this dissonance, we are able to strengthen our cohesion and offer up each week challenging, thoughtful, provocative, and revolutionary ideas to stimulate your Monday morning and move with you in your day with whatever personal revolutions you choose to impart. Kicking off our show, Bill Resnick talks with George Cheney about Mondragon, the largest cooperative enterprise in the world. Clayton Morgeridge reads about the anti-democracy in neoliberalism. Guest Paul Rowland shares a discussion about the politics of community radio. And closing out our show today, Tom Becker brings us thoughts from the left press. Thank you for joining us as always, and stay tuned.
High noon in Gotham City. A deserted warehouse on the outskirts of town. And a ticking bomb spells trouble for Batman and Robin.
Holy, breaking and entering. It's Batgirl.
Quick, Batgirl. Untie us before it's too late.
It's already too late. I've worked for you a long time, and I'm paid less than Robin.
Holy discontent.
Same job, same employer means equal pay for men and women.
No time for jokes, Batgirl.
It's no joke. It's the federal equal pay law.
Holy act of Congress.
Can we talk about this later?
Will Batgirl save the dynamic duo? Will she get equal pay? Tune in tomorrow or contact the Wage and Hour Division listed in your phone book under the U.S. Department of Labor.
George Cheney, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill.
George Cheney has been studying Mondragon for over 20 years. It's the largest worker-owned collective on this planet with 100 separate firms and 100,000, maybe a little less now in the deep recession, owner workers. His classic book is Values at Work, Employee Participation Meets Market Pressure at Mondragon. Mondragon is seen by some as the model of a new form of social humane capitalism. It's seen by others as a demonstration that radical democracy works and is thus a model for socialism. And still others see Mondragon as a big distraction from what's really needed, an effort to build fighting organizations of ordinary workers at the capitalist workplace. George Cheney probably doesn't seek to answer those questions. His focus has been to look at how Mondragon works. How democratic and participative were they and are they? How do its workers and managers balance the need to survive in a capitalist market with an ethic of solidarity and democracy? Before we really begin answering those questions, George, give us a sense of Mondragon's history and its organization.
Sure. It's obviously a very complex organization because it's so large, and it is not what most people think of when they hear the word cooperative or worker cooperative in the United States, because we're really talking now about a multinational corporation with holdings in about 20 countries in addition to the base in the Basque region of Spain or the Basque country. But we can talk about the structure of an individual cooperative or firm within the entire system, and that's very helpful and illuminating, I think, because it's a dual structure with both an elected president and then various councils, and then selected or appointed managers. So it's what I call a dual governance system, which involves checks and balances. And I think that works extremely well, particularly if the councils, which are groups representing different segments of the workforce, are vital and functioning and have a great deal of participation. And that's something I found when I was doing interviews at several points in the 1990s, and that continues to be the case, as I've found on more recent visits. The system as a whole, then, also works on democratic principles, although obviously when you get to an organization that size, and right now there are about 85,000 members, worker owners, it has shrunk a little bit during the recession. When you get to that size, you lose something in terms of direct participation. So one thing that's going on in Mondragon right now is reviving participation by looking at ways to fortify communication channels so that information and opinion can flow upward, which is always an issue in a large organization of any kind, whether it's private, public, or nonprofit. So those are some of the things that I'm looking at with collaborators that are there right now. But for me, one of the great benefits of being able to observe and visit a set of organizations like these over such a long period is seeing how they have changed internally, how they've responded to the market, how they have in some ways departed from core values, then rediscovered some core values, and so forth. You really get to see a lot in the life of an organization over that period of time. And I should mention the co-ops were founded as industrial cooperatives, industrial worker cooperatives, in 1956, but only after about 15 years of careful discussion and preparation on the part of a Basque priest and five young engineers for whom this was really a calling. So now it's the major economic engine in the Basque country in Spain, and no longer anything like a marginal institution. It is it's a giant.
You know, maybe we can get to the fact that even as Spain is in desperate shape and moving towards Greek levels of unemployment and hunger and cutting of state services, Basque country is doing a whole lot better, and partly because of the way Mondragon operates. That's, though, another story. Maybe we can tell that at the end. George, let's talk about some of the indices. One of the great questions is, can in an organization of that size, ordinary workers actually participate? Is it meaningful? And there are 100 firms. I suppose things are very different, somewhat different firm by firm. Can ordinary workers actually participate, get involved in the ethic of cooperation and solidarity, and also solidarity not just with their own colleagues at that organization, but a kind of social solidarity and an effort to build democracy and even identify with people who are not in the collective, that is, ordinary folks?
Those are really good questions, and I'm glad you highlighted solidarity, Bill, because what I found in my interviews, and I did hundreds of interviews in the 1990s across all different types of workers, different generations of workers, and so forth, and I found seven different uses of the term solidarity and seven different levels of practice. And I won't go into all those right now. We don't have time. But just to say briefly, those range from interpersonal solidarity, like camaraderie at work and support for one another at work, all the way to how ups and downs within the system are managed in terms of, for example, if one cooperative or one group of cooperatives is suffering a downturn in the market and is no longer in the black for a particular year, the system is set up with a formula so that those cooperatives are aided by the others. So you have that. And then even beyond the cooperatives themselves, you have solidarity with the community in terms of mandated reinvestment of 10% of the profits into the community. And then even beyond that now, we have several foundations associated with the cooperatives that are promoting economic justice and social justice in less developed parts of the world. So solidarity is extremely important. But back to your question on participation, because practically speaking, that becomes very difficult in a large organization. The general assemblies in the individual cooperatives, which are the highest governing bodies and must meet, you know, by statute at least once a year, those have understandably become rather formal kinds of meetings. In fact, some people joke about them being as predictable as Catholic masses, and that's what I found in the 1990s. However, there are many other kinds of informal discussions as well as the discussions of the councils, and there's a governing council and a management council and also a social council, and the social council is really dedicated to worker concerns, that when those institutions are vital and when participation is strong, they have a great deal of influence. In the 90s, there was some departure from the core values, and even on the part of a couple of the surviving founders, I was able to interview two out of three of those five engineers who helped to found the co-ops. Two out of three of them felt that, to put it kind of simply, that the Mondragon Corporation needed to become a bit more like other multinationals, and some of the policies in the 90s reflected that, to the point that they were, in advertising and marketing, soft-pedaling the fact that they were a worker-owned firm, which I expressed alarm about and was able to engage managers about and so forth. They also were soft-pedaling training in cooperativism and democratic practices, instead favoring or relying almost exclusively on technical training. But that has changed, and with some of the younger generations of managers, and I mean managers who are 35 to 50, let's say right now, they're actually returning to some of the core values, recognizing that those provide strength in tough economic times as well as easier ones, but also keep turnover down, keep commitment to the cooperatives, which for many positions may pay less than the larger market, and so forth. So they're seeing, you know, to use the typical business term, they're seeing the value added in the cooperative dimension of the organization. And the very questions you ask are ones that I have consistently put to managers and elected representatives in the cooperatives. And I'm heartened to see that there's more debate now than there was, say, 15 years ago within the cooperatives about how they can maintain their basic values as they go forward. And I think part of that is they recognize how they're seen in the rest of the world, and there's a certain increased sense of responsibility, that they are something of a beacon for more, a more enlightened form of capitalist corporation.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to George Cheney, whose classic book is Values at Work, Employee Participation Meets Market Pressure at Mondragon. You concluded with the workers, all workers, some workers, that's the question, seeing, recognizing that Mondragon is seen as a positive example of what could be a very different kind of capitalism. In the today's environmental crisis, and what appears to actually most people who are watching carefully and aren't in the employ of the energy industries around the world or any of the other industries that are making it very difficult to talk about climate change intelligently and who own the legislatures and in most of the developed countries right now, it seems to me there really is a not even a long term, but the possibilities of just immense catastrophic changes in climate within the next half century, leading to dystopic, Hollywood dystopic proportions. How is Mondragon dealt with those questions? Are they ready to do that? Is it that their business interests and their interest in maintaining sort of successful business, which of course they have, there's just huge pressure to make it in the market. How do they deal with the increasing possibility of a climate disaster?
That's a great question, and it's actually one of the ones that I'm beginning to work on with a colleague there in the Mondragon University, which is in itself a cooperative. He's a sociologist, and he has other colleagues who are involved in the revival of democratic training programs that I alluded to before. But also, a number of them have strong interests in environmental sustainability, and I mean deep interests. Let's go back 20 years to when I first visited there. I had read one book on Mondragon that suggested it was a kind of ecotopia and that that was an important dimension of the cooperative's commitment to the world. When I got there, I saw virtually no evidence of that. There was in the community at that time very little recycling going on. There was certainly a consciousness of waste in general. I think that came more from the culture and the fact that many of the people there, particularly people who were at least in their 50s at that time, had experienced times of scarcity themselves. However, I saw very little evidence in the policies of the cooperatives, of the corporation as a whole, or other companies in the community to really practice environmental responsibility in a profound way. Today, that's a bit different. They're beginning to consider more the impacts of their own activities on the environment, on their choices of products, and so forth. It's difficult, though, because the heart of the cooperatives, there isn't just the economic pressure, the genuine market pressure that you mentioned, Bill. There's also the fact that many of their products are automotive parts and pipe fittings and things like that, where they're tied up with the practices of those major industries around the world and don't necessarily feel they can influence them heavily. But I'm seeing much more in the discussions, at the including high-level discussions in the corporation now, that because they are such a significant firm, the seventh largest private firm in Spain, that as a leader, they can set better examples in terms of the environment. And certainly around the cooperatives, and by around the cooperatives, I mean people who are involved, have worked for the cooperatives or do now, but are involved in other social projects, a much greater sense of environmental responsibility. And I think the Basques in general are well poised for that ideologically because they have a strong connection to the land, they have a strong sense of history, and they now have a very strong sense of responsibility because of how well known they're becoming in the world. And, you know, up until recently, most of the news about the Basques in Spain was negative in the sense of talk about violent movements toward independence and so forth. That's changed a lot, and people are much more aware, not just in narrow circles, but much more widely, about the Mondragon system and about some of the foundations there and so forth. So I'm hopeful that an environmental commitment is going to be play a much bigger role alongside their traditional core values of participation, solidarity, and equality. And in fact, one of the great things, this is stepping outside of Mondragon for a minute, but also people who have spent a lot of time at Mondragon. There was a huge conference in Quebec last October that made a declaration called Imagine 2012. That was to coincide with the International Year of the Cooperative, which was declared by the United Nations. And one of the strongest principles stated there was environmental sustainability. And I'm seeing that as well in other cooperative, individual cooperatives and cooperative networks in the United States and other parts of the world. Mm. And historically, that was not the case. So what I'm describing as a progression at Mondragon, I think, is also a needed change that we're seeing other places as well. Because I think most worker cooperatives around the world had strong commitments internally to their democratic principles, and then secondarily to the larger community. They didn't say very much about the broader environment, but they're recognizing the urgency that you described.
Yeah, yeah. They're working people, and they need jobs, and they have to support their families. And does the cooperative try, and is there a movement within it? It seems to me there are two things that could be done. One is to try and do their investments in a way that they're, in fact, moving away from the old industrial economy and moving towards a very different kind of production and production of different things and of the really the reconstruction of society around a completely different energy system, among other things, and agricultural system. And that be one thing that they might do internally, although it takes a huge risk, and they could go out of business if they make choices that don't work within the market. That's the dilemma. Another way, though, is to organize for the kind of pan-European, not just Spanish, but investment patterns, taxation patterns, ways of responding to the climate crisis by really reconstructing industry and very fundamentally. Why don't we end on that? Are they capable of looking not themselves just as businesses and having to survive, but of seeing that kind of larger picture and actually taking the kinds of risks that would be necessary ideologically as well as in terms of investment patterns?
I think you stated it very well, and you described those dilemmas and those choices and also the avenues of possibilities for change. There are some people like Tom Webb at the business school at St. Mary's in Halifax who have worked on models of what they call cooperative capital, and I can't get into the details of that right now, but basically it's a way of tying investments to social causes, but involving much bigger blocks of capital, involving many more players, and maintaining ties to core commitments that in this case today would also include environmental responsibility and sustainability. So there are some people working on that. But back to the specifics that you're talking about, I'm most hopeful about the youngest generations at Mondragon because I think there is greater environmental awareness there, and they may ultimately, perhaps not while the Spanish economy is quite as stressed as it is right now, but in a few years, put on the kind of pressure on the cooperative system to say, hey, if we don't change, then who will? And these changes do involve risk, but they can also be done not in every industry in which they're involved at the same time. They can also be done sequentially and so forth, so they can preserve some stability while they're doing it. But because I think the recognition of that necessity is growing there. And there's a greater sense of global responsibility there, just as we see many other places. And that's the kind of message, to the extent possible, that I like to deliver back. And now, having some opportunities to do that because of the amount of time I've spent there over, you know, two decades, to say, hey, if you all aren't going to lead, then who will? And so, which is easy for me to say in the sense that it doesn't affect my employment, but I think I feel sure there's a greater sense of that. And so I'm hoping that some of those influences will work into policies about choices in products, choices in services, choices in markets, the creations of new kinds of markets that they haven't even dealt with, that deal with environmental cleanup and creative approaches to energy efficiency and so forth.
George Cheney, thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate the opportunity.
Right, so long.
It's so good to see the green grass grow again. After years of being careless, now the folks seem to know it's time to pitch in. Time to pitch in. We can breathe a fresher air. There's more beauty everywhere. 'Cause more people seem to care. They're all pitching in.
We've got to pitch in to clean up America.
Yes, America the Beautiful. What a rousing theme, brought to you by a PSA, public service announcement from the 1970s. Pitch in. Keep America beautiful. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick discussing Mondragon with George Cheney. Up next, we have Well Read Red by Clayton Morgeridge. He'll be discussing Corey Robbins' article for The Nation about Nietzsche and Austrian economics. Clayton.
Mainstream discourse continues to refer to the U.S. and many other nations as democracies. But it's pretty obvious that our societies are democratic in name only. The two major parties in the U.S. represent somewhat different branches of the corporate, financial, and military power structure. No candidate or point of view that questions the continued domination of that power structure has a prayer of getting a serious hearing in a political campaign. In the economic sphere, everything about production and labor, including whether there's any work for us and the conditions in which we have to do that work, is determined by a class of super-rich owners and managers whose only responsibility is to profit. In short, we live in an authoritarian plutocracy, not in a democracy. Now, can there be any justification for this domination of our lives by a tiny elite? Well, for the most part, we don't even ask this question, distracted as we are by the spectacle of electoral politics, which produces the illusion that elections somehow determine government policies, an illusion that persists in spite of a long history of broken promises by politicians who present one face when running for office, but merge back into the ruling elite once in office. The dominance of corporate profit-making over our lives is also obscured by the mythology of a free market, in which corporations produce what we freely demand and where we freely choose our jobs and our careers. But the underlying philosophy of neoliberalism, the primacy of the unregulated market, provides a positive but mostly unspoken rationale for the rule of the wealthy. A recent article by Corey Robin demonstrates that its roots in the work of its intellectual fathers, Joseph Schumpeter and Friedrich Hayek in particular, in their work, neoliberalism is profoundly anti-democratic. And I'll be quoting extensively from Robin's article in The Nation magazine. Friedrich Nietzsche despised the crass values of the market, but he also hated socialism and democracy. At a time when slavery was being abolished around the world and socialist movements were growing, Nietzsche made the claim that slavery belongs to the essence of a culture. In an early work, Nietzsche denounced the modern era for its dedication to the dignity of work. Committed to equal rights for all, democracy elevates the worker and the slave. Their demands for justice threaten to swamp all other ideas, to tear down the walls of culture. Modernity has made a monster in the working class. It has the temerity to see itself and its labor as a work of art. Even worse, it seeks to be recognized and publicly acknowledged as such. Now, Nietzsche was a big fan of ancient Greece, whose vast cultural and military achievements rested on slavery. The immortal works of the few had infinitely more value than the lives of all the slaves, even though those enslaved lives were necessary to those cultural achievements. Throughout his writing life, Nietzsche was plagued by the vision of workers massing on the public stage, whether in trade unions, socialist parties, or communist leagues. There is nothing more terrible, he wrote, than a class of barbaric slaves who have learned to regard their existence as an injustice and now prepare to avenge not only themselves but all generations. A generation later, free market economists located the creative forces in society not in the artist, writer, or warrior, but in the entrepreneur. For Joseph Schumpeter, writing in the 1940s, the entrepreneur possesses extraordinary physical and nervous energy. That energy gives him focus, the maniacal, almost brutal ability to shut out what is inessential. It is the entrepreneur's ability to recognize that sweet spot of novelty and occasion, an untried technology, a new method of production, a different way to market or distribute a product, that enables him to revolutionize the way business gets done. Part opportunist, part fanatic, he is a leading man, Schumpeter suggests, overcoming all resistance in order to create the new modes and orders of everyday life. In the competition of the market, the entrepreneur emerges as a legislator of values and new ways of being. To act with confidence beyond the range of the familiar beacons and to overcome resistance requires aptitudes that are present in only a small fraction of the population, and that defines the entrepreneurial type. And yet, even as he sketched the broad outline of this legislator of value, Schumpeter sensed that his days were numbered. Innovation was increasingly the work of departments, committees, and specialists. Now, Friedrich Hayek, writing in the 1960s, argues that the freedom to create and market products must be made universal, because we can never know in advance from whom the next big thing will come. Deep inside Hayek's understanding of freedom is the notion that the freedom of some is worth more than the freedom of others, according to Corey Robbins. The freedom that will be used by only one man in a million may be more important to society and more beneficial to the majority than any freedom we can all use. The overwhelming majority of men and women, Hayek says, are simply not capable of breaking with settled patterns of thought and practice. Given a choice, they would never opt for anything new, never do anything better than what they do now. Hayek is explicit that the possession of vast amounts of wealth and capital, even or especially wealth that has been inherited, is necessary for the creation of new values. Often, says Hayek, it is only the very rich who can afford new products or tastes. Lavishing money on these boutique items, they give producers the opportunity to experiment with better designs and more efficient methods of production. Thanks to their patronage, producers will find cheaper ways of making and delivering those products. Cheap enough, that is, for the majority to enjoy them. What was before a luxury of the idle rich, stockings, automobiles, piano lessons, the university, is now an item of mass consumption. The most important contribution of great wealth, however, is that it frees its possessor from the pursuit of money, so that he can pursue non-material goals. Liberated from the workplace and the rat race, the idle rich, a phrase Hayek seeks to reclaim as a positive good, can devote themselves to patronizing the arts, subsidizing worthy causes like abolition or penal reform, founding new philanthropies and cultural institutions. Well, the two important lessons I think can be learned from Corey Robbins' analysis of neoliberal anti-democratic ideology are these. First, we must understand how deeply contemptuous the thinking of our ruling elite is about democracy, about the ability of ordinary people to govern the direction of their lives. So there is no point in arguing with the elite by appealing to the principles of democracy. They just don't share them. Second, we might acknowledge the point that Hayek makes that creating new values, new ways of life, does require freedom from the workplace and the rat race. But rather than surrender this creativity to the idle rich, we need to organize around the freedom of everyone from work through shorter work weeks and/or a guaranteed national income. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
So without further ado, here's the fabulous Johnny Cash.
Now I taught the weeping willow how to cry, and I showed the clouds how to cover up a clear blue sky. And the tears that I cried for that woman gonna flood you, big river, and I'm gonna sit right here until I die. I met her accidentally in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it told me up every time I heard her drawl, southern drawl. Then I heard my dream, went back downstream, cavorting in Davenport, and I followed you, big river, when you called.
Johnny Cash with Big River. Before that, we heard Clayton Morgridge talking about the anti-democracy of neoliberalism with a well-read red. Up next, we have guest Paul Roland. As some of you know, KBOO has been experiencing some growing pains, to put it mildly. Paul Roland gives us some history of community radio and why it is so important and as well as difficult to maintain.
Since you're listening to this program, you probably have some sense of the history and of the importance of community radio. You may know that community radio as we know it today began largely with the visionary project of Lewis Hill and Associates, who started Pacifica Radio with KPFA in Berkeley, which went on the air in 1949. At the time, the idea of a listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station not connected to a university or other large institution was a new one and had never been implemented. But did you know that over 20 years before that, another activist visionary, Edward Knuckles, president of the Chicago Federation of Labor, helped start WCFL, which was known as the Voice of Labor from 1926 until it was sold in 1987? Knuckles is said to have pioneered the concepts of independent voice and listener support in radio, and WCFL, though it ended up being a commercial station, can also be considered a forerunner of today's community stations, though not widely recognized as such. That is one of the many interesting things I've discovered while doing research for some programs looking at the state of community radio today. What spurred me to embark on this project is the current situation here at KBOO, where there seem to be different visions of how to confront a number of difficulties that are facing us. These began most acutely with the general economic crisis that hit us in 2008, but also include an increasingly saturated media environment with the rise of the internet, MP3 players, Pandora, satellite radio, and other technological developments, the end of government grants for stations like ours, changing demographics, and, I would venture to say, the concerted effort to marginalize and co-opt dissent and non-commercial, cooperative, and community-based cultural initiatives of the kind that flourished in the 1960s and which gave rise to a wave of radio stations like KBOO. Still, for 45 years, KBOO's model of listener-supported, largely volunteer-based, and participatory radio production and programming and democratic governance has succeeded in offering a wide diversity of music, news, arts and culture, and public affairs. This, I think, isn't to be taken lightly or for granted. How many other grassroots community institutions do you know of have been around for this long and have been as consistently true to their mission and values? Now, rather than talking directly about what's happening at KBOO, though I do feel we need to do more of that on the air and better, I decided at first to reach out to some longtime community radio people to get their perspectives. The first interview aired on KABU was with Norman Stockwell, who has been with WORT in Madison, Wisconsin for 30 years. WORT is the only station in the U.S. with a management collective, which has worked successfully for many years. Stockwell is the operations manager there and is a staff representative on the station's board of directors. He has hosted the program of public affairs since 1989 and has covered many national events, including the WTO meetings and protests in Seattle and Cancun, the FTA meetings in Miami, and the Democratic and Republican conventions, several of them. He's active with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, the Grassroots Radio Coalition, Indie Media, and the World Association of Community Broadcasters. I'd like to share with you a few clips I thought most relevant from that interview, aired on Political Perspectives a month ago. I first asked Norm about the conflicts that erupted at Pacifica in the late 1990s. He had a role in the resolution of that crisis and served on the Affiliates Committee of the Interim Pacifica National Board in 2002, which developed Pacifica's current affiliates network, of which KABU is a member.
Starting in about the mid to late 90s, there were some changes going on at Pacifica nationally, and stations like ours around the country got together to support the volunteers and staff as well at the Pacifica stations that were undergoing various forms of threats and restrictions from their management, their national board, and their executive management. And we formed together to support the idea of keeping community radio community, keeping the notion of the grassroots, bottom-up kind of governance and content as well. So in the late 90s, 1999, I think it was, there was a lockout at KPFA down in Berkeley. What we did at our station and a couple other stations around the country did is we would begin the news with an announcement about some of the labor strife that was happening at Pacifica. There was at that time a union struggle around certain issues at a couple of the stations, and so we would announce that. And then there was a period where we and a few other stations withheld our fees to Pacifica, sort of in the form of a rent strike, based on the concept of rent strike, that we were withholding our payments until certain concerns were addressed. Coming out of that, there was a lot of other work around the country by people supporting Pacifica, and eventually there were some changes at the top. A new board was elected, bylaws were rewritten, and so on. And a new affiliates program was created. And the notion here was that we, the affiliates, and at that time it was 60-plus stations, now it's, I think, well over 120 stations around the country, wanted a voice how things are done in the network, and we wanted some kind of a responsive relationship. And so Pacifica hired an affiliates coordinator who works with all the affiliates now and revamped the affiliates program and put two seats on the board of directors representing the affiliate stations. And so that all came out of this struggle in the late 90s, early 2000s. And now, you know, we're trying to work together to move things forward. There's a lot of other issues that Pacifica is faced with, financial crises, issues within the individual stations. But the idea of the affiliates program is for all of us in the world of community radio around the country to move forward this notion of a network of progressive community radio stations and to share content. And we have the thing called the Audio Port, which is an internet-based distribution service. There's the KU satellite. There's lots of ways of getting this Pacifica programming and sharing it amongst stations. That's one of the main kind of outcomes of this new affiliates program, is this collaboration that we're able to do.
And also the Free Speech Radio News kind of came out of that whole episode.
Yeah, Free Speech Radio News actually is basically a strike by reporters at Pacifica National, where they decided that people who were reporting decided they didn't want to participate in this again because of the labor struggles and other things that were going on. And so they created an independent news network, which has now survived and thrived about 13 years now. I think February of 2000 is when they started. And that is a really exciting model of creating an international news program using reporters spread out across the globe, contributors, stringers, and so on, as well as staff, and assembling the news program in about four different locations at once. There's a producer in one city, there's headlines done in another city, the technical production in another city. And so it's really an exciting model, and it's only possible, I think, because of some of the technologies that are available now for us in the community radio world that wouldn't have been available 15 years ago.
Norm goes into detail about different approaches to the types of challenges that KABU and other community stations are facing.
A lot lot of stations have responded to the funding crisis and to the changing demographics of listenership and the, for lack of a better word, let's say the aging listenership to community radio. And so a lot of stations have chosen models that I personally disagree with. And one of those models is what's referred to as professionalizing. And I think that we saw this in the late 80s sweeping across the country in a thing called the Healthy Stations Project. I've seen it in other forms. And by the way, not just community radio. We've seen the same thing happen in the food co-ops. We've seen the same thing happen in the environmental movement in the same ways, that people sort of move to this idea of professional staff are better than volunteer staff. And what I always argued at the time, and still would argue, is that you can be professional without professionalizing. That is, you can have people who do a good show, who do a good job of their show, and who abide by standards of good quality programming without having to fire all the volunteers and hire paid people to do it. So some stations, and we've seen these struggles in many community stations around the country, have done this where they've, you know, pushed out the volunteers and gone to paid people, or where they've homogenized programming in various ways, thinking that that will increase their listenership. And another person in community radio used to say, you know, commercial radio has shown that you increase listenership by homogenizing programming. And I would always turn to him and I'd say, no, commercial radio has shown that one way to increase listenership is to homogenize programming. But we have another way in the community radio world, which is bringing together all this rich knowledge and talent of the volunteers and members of our community and having them share that with the listening audience in an organized and programmatic way. And so I think that when a station is looking at these questions, they need to really be careful of what models they're looking at. There's so many models coming out of business schools that are based on IBM and AT&T and so on. There's not a lot out there about how to do programming in a different way, or how to run an organization in a different way, a collective, a cooperative, and so on. There's a small pool of literature on these topics, and I think that, you know, any station that wants to look at making change needs to really look at more options than just the one narrow view of program change that you see coming out of the documentation of what happens in the commercial radio world.
Before I actually got to talk to you, Norm, I was talking to one of your colleagues at WRT, and they were mentioning, and I'd like to get your take on this, that during the uprising, the whole public employees union controversy, the occupation of the state capitol in Wisconsin, that it definitely galvanized people, certainly in your listening area at that time. And from what I understand, you actually had your best pledge drive ever, and your listenership was up, and it just seemed like that the role that WRT was playing in terms of on-the-ground reporting, actually getting the voices of people that maybe the mainstream media weren't getting, so people were really more engaged, more enthusiastic about what was coming over the airwaves. There was more participation, and it sort of had a synergistic effect. Is that your take on what happened at that time?
Definitely. We were very actively involved in covering the events that were going on here in Madison. The fact that our people were there sleeping in the Capitol, reporting live from the Capitol, broadcasting live from the rallies, made WRT a go-to place for information about what was really happening. And we had a lot of people tuning in from around the country to find out what was happening here in Madison, Wisconsin during that time. You know, it's interesting because we talked a little bit, and I want to get back to it, about technologies. And some people have said, oh, well, why do you need a community radio newsroom anymore when everybody can just be a blogger from their living room or their kitchen on their own laptop? And the thing that happens in a newsroom is you have a bunch of people together, and they're talking to each other, and they're sharing ideas, and they're bouncing things off of each other. And that makes for better quality content and more vibrant and more alive content than somebody sitting cloistered in their apartment typing a blog. And I think that's one of the differences between community radio and some of the new internet technologies that are out there, is that we provide a place for people to interact and to grow and to learn and become better journalists through this interaction. So that's what happened here for us during the Capitol protests and before and after, is that, you know, we have a vibrant participatory newsroom, and that's what makes our news so connected to the community we live in.
And that was Norm Stockwell, longtime community radio activist, journalist, and program host with WORT in Madison, Wisconsin. Back to KBOO. We are facing a number of difficulties and challenges, But then who isn't? I think we all realize how incredibly serious the economic, social, environmental, and political situation we're in is, which is why we need grassroots, independent community media like KBOO as never before. The key to keep KBOO going and thriving as a voice of diversity and dissent, of collective empowerment and education, is active involvement and participation. Come to the board and committee meetings. Donate if you can. Vote in the upcoming board election. Even consider running for the board. Come down and volunteer. Tell your friends and family and coworkers about KBOO. Spread the word and send program links by email and social media. The more I read and talk to people about it, the more remarkable and precious listener-sponsored community radio seems to me. It's local and homegrown, yet connected by phone, satellite, and internet to the rest of the country and the world. It's a model that is basically durable and sustainable, but it does need nurturing and support, especially in difficult times. And I have no doubt that it will come under increased scrutiny and pressure. So help KBOO keep doing what it's doing, and do it even better. And if there are changes that would help us do better, let's make them together and in an open, democratic, and participatory way, starting with those who really listen to and care about what comes over the airwaves. For the Old Mole, this is Paul Rowland.
Well, books, every few days I have to tell a man or a woman something I don't want to. I've been practicing medicine for 29 years and I still don't know how to do it well.
Why don't you just say it flat out?
All right. You have a cancer. Advanced.
Long before that picture was made, I did the same scene in real life. 12 years ago. Cost me a piece of lung. We've made real progress with cancer since then, and we're close to making more. But it costs money. The American Cancer Society is asking you for help again. You're pretty lucky. Could be the other way around.
Wayne? Yeah, we just heard John Wayne there talking about his cancer. And, you know, there's a board meeting tonight. You listen to that last program. And you can get, it starts at 6 o'clock. I don't think you need to lose a lung for that to get here. Concluding our show today, we have Tom Becker reading from his insights from the Left Press. Tom.
Good morning. Have you ever considered that a fair minimum wage might do more than benefit the lowest wage earners and actually trickle up and contribute to a more equitable distribution of salaries and wages across the entire wage spectrum? Today I'm going to share with you an article arguing that such would be the case. It is entitled The Path to Wage-Led Growth, Worker Productivity, and the Minimum Wage by John Schmidt. Between 1979 and 2012, Schmidt begins, after accounting for inflation, the productivity of the average American worker increased about 85%. Over the same period, the inflation-adjusted wage of the median wage worker rose only about 6%, and the value of the minimum wage fell by 21%. As a country, we got richer, but workers in the middle saw little of the gains, and workers at the bottom actually fell behind. The economy did not always work this way. From the end of World War II through 1968, the wages for workers in the middle and even the minimum wage tracked productivity closely. The economy, bolstered by labor, civil rights, and women's movements, greatly expanded opportunity and delivered strong wage growth at the middle and even at the bottom. By the 1970s, however, conservatives and corporate interests had had enough. They regained control of the political system and enacted a series of economic changes that, taken together, greatly reduced the bargaining power of workers at the middle and bottom of the wage distribution. The link between productivity growth and wages was broken. The refusal to pass legislation maintaining the value of the federal minimum wage, now at $7.25 per hour, was one of the most visible manifestations of the shift in policy. At first glance, it may be hard to see why the minimum wage is relevant to the middle class. But the relevance jumps out if we consider where the minimum wage would be today. If, as was the case during the early post-war period, the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity growth from its high-water mark in 1968. Even with a conservative measure of productivity growth, the minimum wage today would still be about $16 per hour. To put this in perspective, in 2012, the median worker in the United States, that is, the worker exactly in the middle of all wage earners, made about $16 per hour. A $16 per hour minimum wage, in line with what we paid minimum wage workers in 1968 relative to the productivity level of the time, would be equal to or higher than the earnings of half of all U.S. workers. This is a radically different world from the one we now inhabit. Obviously, workers at the bottom would be earning much more, but so too would workers in the middle, whose earnings over the past three decades have moved much more in line with wages at the bottom than at the top. Meanwhile, top earners, who have received by far the largest share of productivity gains since the end of the 1970s, would have given up much of those gains to workers at the middle and bottom. In our age of diminished expectations, talking about a $16 per hour minimum wage can induce a serious case of sticker shock. But remember, adjusting for productivity growth, we already paid workers the equivalent of $16 per hour back in 1968. The higher rate simply amounts to maintaining the same degree of wage inequality we had then, and letting the earnings of workers at the bottom, middle, and top grow at the same rate from that point on, exactly as happened in the 1950s and 60s. Raising the minimum wage overnight to $16 would almost certainly do more harm than good, as employers would struggle to cope with a sudden jump in costs. Large swaths of the contemporary economy are organized around low wages. If wages had been rising regularly with average productivity, employers would have made different decisions about technology and the way work gets done, with no impact on long-run employment. But moving from the low road to the high road will involve rethinking production techniques and making new investments, which will take time. A fair way to determine the minimum wage is to index it to the median wage or to the average wage, which is usually higher than the median. The average wage gives more weight to those at the very top, so when inequality is rising, as it has since the 1970s, the average grows faster than the median. At its high water mark in the late 1960s, the minimum wage was probably equal to slightly more than half of the median wage and slightly less than half of the average wage. Using half of the median wage as a benchmark today would put us at about $8 per hour, only a bit higher than the current $7.25. This relatively low level goes to deeper problems with the economy. In recent decades, median workers, too, have trailed well behind the productivity growth. Linking to average wages produce a higher number. According to the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics data, the average hourly earnings of all employees is just under $24 per hour. At 50% of the average, that would put the minimum wage today at about $12, well above the current $7.25, though still well short of $16. Indexing to average wages actually makes more sense because average wages have moved much more closely in line with productivity than median wages. The average wage has tracked productivity more closely because top earners, lawyers, doctors, corporate and financial managers, have captured the lion's share of productivity gains, and their gains have driven up the average even as middle wage workers have made little progress. A minimum wage tied to average wages is more likely to keep pace with average productivity, providing the best guarantee that low-wage workers stay connected to the rest of the economy, and the wage push from the bottom will inevitably spill over to wages in the middle. Ultimately, what a workable middle-out economic seeks is a return to wage-led growth, where regular increases in wages are the source of smoothly growing aggregate demand in the economy. For more than three decades, the economy has relied instead on what could be called bubble-led growth, trickle down from the spending of the top 1%, or unsustainable bubbles in the stock market or housing to spur growth. A higher minimum wage is on its own not enough to put the economy on a wage-led growth path, but is a simple and essential part of any broader plan that would. I've been reading an article by John Schmidt entitled The Path to Wage-Led Growth, Worker Productivity, and the Minimum Wage. John Schmidt is a senior economist with the Center of Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C.
All right. Okay, thanks so much, Tom. That concludes our show for today. But don't go anywhere. Looks like I need to go on to Tom's mic here. Oh, yeah, that sounds a lot better. Okay, don't go anywhere today because at 10 o'clock we have Air Cascadia with locally produced news, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Locust Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guests are Zach Porter, campaign coordinator for All Against the Hall in Missoula, and Linwood Laffey with Fighting Goliath, who are both deeply involved in fighting the Alberta Tar Sands Project. Yeah, and you know, you can hear all or parts of the show today if you like our Facebook page. I think we'll have a link to the entire Paul Rowland segment of our show today, learning more about
community radio and how you can get involved. And speaking of which, there is a board meeting tonight, 6 p.m. Come join us. Thank you so much, as always, for listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour, and hope you have a great week.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Air Cascadia with Chris Andre.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, June 24th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Well, under a murky federal tax policy, businesses that export goods can set up subsidiary companies to get a tax